Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. It is March 5th, the year 2011. In this show, our focus is on the study of esoteric, mystical, and spiritual teachings and comparative studies with modern science and psychology. We explore the psychology of the soul, psychology of consciousness, and we also discuss the psychopathology of humankind, which is going to be part of our focus today in exploring the magnus opus of G.I. Gurdjieff, a fascinating book called Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And we're going to be focusing on that book today. And before I begin, I'd like to just make several announcements. The first is that I'll be a guest this coming Thursday evening on Don Nikoloff's show on BBS Radio. It's Thursday night at 1 o'clock, so it's actually Friday morning Eastern time at 1 o'clock. But so Thursday the 10th, I'll be on with Don Nikoloff. And then also the following week on Tuesday, will be a guest with Jim Fetzer. Dr. Jim Fetzer is a major 9/11 researcher. And I'll be discussing the article that I wrote entitled Fabled Airplanes, which is an analysis of the September Clues video series documenting the media coverage of the day's events on 9/11. And I did a 40-page article I wrote up looking at that video series to try to explain. It's a complex video series to watch because it's not narrated, but there's only script. And, it's mainly script that explains the items in the video. But anyway, I did a long article on that. And that'll be the discussion with Jim Fetzer next Tuesday, or a week next Tuesday. So those are two upcoming events. I would encourage people to have a look at my website at zeropoint.ca, and you can see my article up there on fabled airplanes. And I've just recently extracted a number of pictures from the video series, which I've used to illustrate the article. So if you've looked at it before, you might want to relook at the article because it's illustrated now, which really helps a lot. Also, one other thing, I've just had part three of an article series accepted for publication. This is an article series which has been published through the EsotericStudies.net journal, and the series is on the origins of human consciousness. And part one was on the heart doctrine, and part two was on the zero point hypothesis, and part three is entitled Towards a Holographic Metaphysics of the Human Heart, and it's looking at the possible basis for the heart as in the sense of being a microcosm of the macrocosm. Because in my work, I would maintain that there is a higher dimensional physics and metaphysics to the human heart. This article gives an explanation of that, and it's based on a classic account by Yogananda in Autobiography of a Yogi, where Yogananda has this experience of cosmic consciousness. And at the end of it, he feels his consciousness come back to his body, and he states that somehow, from a point of intuitive perception within his heart, irradiating splendor, I forget the exact wording of it, but somehow that the universe was embodied within his heart, that his experience of the vastness of the outer universe was all somehow related to a point of intuitive perception within his heart. And this is the basis for the article, trying to look at the higher dimensional holographic physics of the human heart. So I hope that article has been accepted for publication. I have to revise it, so it'll be about another month before that'll be available online for viewing. Okay, so I'm going to bring my co-host on today because we have been promising for several months now to do a series of discussions on Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. And so I do want to get back to doing that. We've put it off several times. Jim or I were absent, or we had other guests and such. So I'll bring my co-host on, Jim Moffitt from Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
Okay, good. Have you found any time over the last weeks to be looking at Beelzebub's tales?
Well, I've been looking at it, but much slower than I'd wanted. I actually find I got a little bit bogged down in it as I was going along, but as I said before on a previous program, reading it again, this is... I read it in its entirety, and then I read parts of it in terms of trying to research it and read selections. So this is really only the second time I've ever read it, like cover to cover. So I found that I've grasped it a lot more. I still, in a way, I was struck in rereading it that at times, like because I have such a background in studying Gurdjieff's teaching and know so much about his other presentations, I'm not sure how somebody could possibly get this without having other knowledge of his teaching. Like in a way, like it's so disguised and so buried and presented in such a difficult fashion that even knowing a lot about his teaching, you really have to work to try to discern what he's saying. And I mean, I appreciate what he's doing, but as I say, I know the book can be read on its own, but I just, you know, I question, like, who would be able to just read this book and get Gurdjieff's teaching out of it? Like, I just find that almost impossible to believe that somebody could do that. Having said that, you know, the book is so multi-layered and is so deep, and it's told in this allegorical form, and he achieves a lot of things in the way that he uses language and the way that he throws people off that you know, really are... achievements above and beyond, like a straight exposition, which he obviously was capable of doing. So there's this other side of it to it. But more and more I see how this really makes most sense when it's read in conjunction, or when it's taken in by somebody who has seen the other side of Gurdjieff's presentation of his teaching and more the straightforward kind of more intellectual exposition of his ideas. Oh, by the way. Yogananda says that I cognize the center of the Empyrean, meaning like the highest layers of the heaven, highest levels of the heavens, as a point of intuitive perception in my heart.
Oh yeah, the center of the Empyrean. Yeah, and in classical cosmology, there were seven heavens, so
yes.
It would be like the seventh heaven, like the penultimate level.
And then he follows that by saying, irradiating splendor. So, like, this bliss issued from my nucleus to every part of the universal structure. So, in a sense, it's another way of saying that he was at one with the cosmos. But, again, if you don't understand, I mean, I read Autobiography of Yogi more than 30 years ago, and I read that, and you read it, and we both... You know, I thought, well, that's really astonishing, like that description and everything. But it wasn't until you began to articulate the heart doctrine, began to dig it out of the esoteric teachings, that we realized that the central importance of that intuitive perception in my heart, a point of intuitive perception, and that's such a critical choice of phrase that he uses, that somehow this point source within his own heart is integrally related to the whole structure of the universe, and that every aspect of the universe is knowable within. It's like that quote from the Chandogya Upanishad where it says, as vast as the universe is outside, the universe is inside, is equally as vast within us, or something to that effect. But the idea that, that the higher dimensional realities of our own being, which are knowable through the heart, are somehow structurally related to the entire universe, so that all of our ideas about the separability and the locality of time and space are somehow fundamentally wrong on it, but that somehow that there's this non-local holographic reality that is revealed in the higher dimensions of the human heart.
Yeah, exactly. Non-local is such an important term, because the holographic model, in a way, it belies our normal understanding of the nature of space. Like, it's like how Blavatsky says, space is an illusion. And in a way, it's like everything that manifests in creation is really a projection out of higher dimensional space. So, I was very pleased. You know, that article series, Jim, I was trying to do a third article to summarize it on the and to get into the new views that I developed on holography based on Blavatsky's work, but I found it so incredibly complex to try to explain the holographic paradigm, but then not only to explain what the holographers were talking about in the 1980s when the paradigm first emerged, and it was the work of Carl Priebram and David Bohm, but then to go on to explain the new idea of holography in modern physics, which has to do more with these ideas like about black holes in higher dimensional space, and it's a whole new model of holography. And I found in that first article I just couldn't cover the whole. So I broke it into two pieces. And the first piece deals with Yogananda, Priebram, and David Bohm, and the basic concept of the heart as a holographic, as embodying the universe. And then my fourth section to that will be an innovative article proposing, you know, monadic elements in hyperspace, and, you know, the idea of these sevenfold holes dug in space, and so going into the really more complex ideas about holography.
Like
if anyone is interested in what I'm trying to refer to, you can go to my website, and I put up some of my more advanced writings on the subject up on the website.
So, Chris, you're talking about like the ideas of like the seven compacted dimensions and the black hole computers. Is that the ideas that?
Yeah, in the new idea of holography, they have part of the concept is that how a black hole, a mini black hole, could function like an information processor, and that as energy or matter is absorbed into a black hole, it spews out information. So in the new model of holography and physics, they postulate the existence of black holes in hyperspace, or what they call anti-de Sitter space, and the activities of a black hole in hyperspace can be rendered equivalent to material processes and particles on different levels of the Akasha, or ether, or the holographic plate. It's hard to explain, and we'll come back to it, you know, after we've been through the Beelzebub series. We'll come back to that and try to explore that in more detail. But generally, like, my understanding of a human being now, in a way, is that we have a divine source or divine spark, and this exists in higher dimensional space, and this element has certain spin properties. And I think it's composed, like Blavatsky says, the laws of nature are due to seven holes dug in space. So it's like holes in hyperspace. And these holes have spin properties, which Blavatsky talks about in The Secret Doctrine, how the higher dimensional divine intelligences, they function through spin. spin, the spin energy. So the spin properties, I would say, of a monad in hyperspace, the spin properties of that then create bodies surrounding a central point. And those are like our different bodies that exist at different levels of the cosmos, like the astral level and the mental level and so on. So that's the general idea. But we'll come back in about a month and explore that in more detail.
I was kind of relieved to hear you say that about, I mean, you're just talking about the latter developments in holography, but even trying to relate the, see, I've been trying to do that for a while and trying to write about your work in the book that I'm writing, and it's difficult to reduce such incredibly complex ideas to just a few pages in a chapter and, you know, to really convey, like, to somebody how extraordinarily different this whole perspective is and what, like, but that is quite logical and it's very coherent and it's establishes these connections between the mystical and esoteric teachings and modern scientific findings and theoretical positions, and that they're entirely congruent and actually in some ways the mystical and esoteric perspective provides a greater depth and provides a perspective that's missing because science deals with only with the material, and there's obviously a spiritual dimension to all of this too that's lacking in modern science's perspective. But then to try to explain all that in a few pages is very, very difficult to grasp it. But I just wanted to say one thing about, you were talking about Yogananda's experience, and one of the things that is often said by skeptics or those who are critical of scientific people from a scientific perspective who are critical of religious teachings is that religion and by extension mystical teachings never predict anything that would be discovered in modern science, and that is so completely untrue and so completely wrong that it's amazing mm-hmm. that keeps being repeated. But basically what that really is based on, what that's grounded in is the people who are saying that are essentially ignorant about what mystical and esoteric teachings teach and provide this fundamentalist interpretation of what religions teach and then say, well, there's nothing but these fundamentalist ideas in religion. But really, they're just basing this conclusion on their own ignorance because precisely the opposite is true. There's all sorts of things that have been anticipated, and there's all sorts of things that are consistently held within the mystical and esoteric teachings, such as the pervasiveness of the heart doctrine, and that these ideas are not only stated over and over again, but they're empirically they're capable of being examined empirically and being weighed and assessed in a scientific manner. But one thing that really strikes me is that in the heart doctrine you're discussing, and actually the other book, it might be, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the title of God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, where you're talking about the guy who wrote quantum physics, or the Nick Herbert, his book on quantum realities, mm-hmm. and he's talking about non-locality and the idea of non-locality in modern physics, and he says, quantum reality beyond the new physics. He says how much physicists hate the idea of non-locality, but it's there. I mean, it's undeniable that this has been established scientifically, and yet they hate it because it really undermines the whole perspective, the materialist perspective. At the best, it relativizes in the sense that you have to recognize the existence of some order of reality above and beyond the time-space complex in which physics generally applies itself. And what you have in Yogananda and what you have in other mystical claims are repeated experiences of people who directly experience non-local reality. Like, yeah. Yogananda's experience not only transcends space, like he's at one with the universe, so he's everywhere in the universe, but he also transcends time because he talks about observing different world orders being created out of flame and light and of everything crystallizing and materializing in the universe. And he's seeing all this in his experience of cosmic consciousness. So clearly, you know, time and space don't exist for him, and he's having a direct experience of non-local reality. Well, 100 years ago, in terms of physics, there would be no way that you would say that what he was saying could be real. But now we know it could be real because he's describing a non-local reality. So I'd say that's a rather persuasive and...
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, it's like 60 years after Yogananda wrote it, we finally arrived at a model of physics that we could understand what he was claiming.
Yeah, we could place that perspective in. And he's not the only person who's had these experiences. Many mystical experiences describe this transcendence of the time-space complex. And it's funny because that's one of those things that I like to jump on and say, oh, I felt myself as being one with the universe. And they dismiss it. They poo-poo it as being some sort of... poetic or of some sort of not anomalous experience, but actually,
or a metaphor
exactly.
Yeah,
and yet it's such a profound experience. And Yogananda has another chapter in his book, The Law of Miracles, in which he describes, and he's conversant with the ideas of Einstein and James Jeans and Sir Arthur Eddington, and he talks about the Law of Miracles and what's happening in terms of what a yogi's actually doing when he has these experiences, and he couches it in terms of modern science. So he was clearly, you know, he had one foot in one world and the other in the other world, and that's what I think is partly really arresting about his description and about his account of it, is that not only does he describe it, but he accounts for it too, which is really quite extraordinary. And again, like I say, even when you read it the first time, we both read that book in the 1970s, and I remember you telling me, and I actually cite this story, that one of your students had come to you when you were first kind of getting into the ideas of holography and the importance of light, and reminded you of Yogananda's experience of cosmic consciousness, and you went back and reread it, and realized, oh, you know, there's a lot more here than I grasped the first time. And that really applies to everything we talk about in terms of these programs, is that you can grasp it on some of these ideas on a certain level, but you have to keep returning to them and keep working with them, because it's so complex, and you have to know more and more about yourself and about the universe and everything in between to really grasp the import of what's being said. Like over and over again, I don't know. I've never seen anybody who, even people who are sympathetic to esoteric or mystical teachings or who profess to study them, I've never seen any articulation of the heart doctrine. Yet it's there. It's so blatantly, obviously there. And again, I think even some of those people think that this is meant to be a metaphor or some sort of poetic illusion. But you're saying no, this is meant to be understood literally and can be investigated scientifically and can be modeled in terms of a physics and a metaphysics of consciousness. And that just goes to show that you have to have a certain understanding of things to be able to grasp what's really being said, which brings us back to Beelzebub, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the best example of how you understand something more and more deeply as you grow in the way of that knowledge. Like, as I have read Beelzebub's tales, it must have been 40 years ago almost that we began to read that. When we began our Gurdjieff studies, we were both in our early 20s.
Well, probably about 35, because I think it was 1975, 76. So, yeah, about 35 years ago.
Oh, yeah, 35 years ago. Yeah, was it. Yeah.
I keep wanting to discount that by about 10 years, by the way.
yeah, really. Yeah, it's hard to accept all these years that have piled up.
They're piling up, yes.
Yeah. And it's such an amazing book, and even now, I've written my book, The Slugs, explaining Beelzebub's tales, but I find as I reread it this year, and I've been going back to do a further edit on The Slugs and add new material, and it just reveals new levels of subtleness and complexity and different teachings that I hadn't even been aware of before. It's an amazing book like that, and it's something, it becomes a lifelong companion. Like,
yeah.
You know how they say if you were stuck on
yeah.
an island and you had three books to take?
Right.
Take Beelzebub's Tales.
Yeah, yeah.
I would take that. The Bible, I think, would have to be up there.
I'd take How to Build a Raft myself, but yeah, no, it's that kind of book. It has that gravitas. It has incredible depth and complexity. And the more you put into it, the more you get out of it. I think John Bennett, who was a Gurdjieff pupil, claimed that he'd read it 40 times or something like that.
Wow, like,
yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Boy.
And you know, and Bennett has a little book on Beelzebub's Tales, which is a very slim book, really. I mean, there's not really much to it. It's good. Like, what he says is, I think, is interesting, but it's odd that in terms of its importance, it's like the secret doctrine, you know, is that the two of the greatest works in the history of Western esotericism and in terms of Western literature, more broadly speaking, because the secret doctrine is not really literature, but there's these incredibly deep books, but there's precious little really written about either of them that explaining what's said in them.
Yeah, it really is quite remarkable that. And as you say, like, there's very little to Bennett's book, his notes
yeah.
on Beelzebub's Tales, and he doesn't give a good overview of the story.
Yeah.
Like, he has chapters on different items or teachings or distinctions that Beelzebub makes, but he doesn't give an overview of what the story is about. And
yeah.
I think what amazed me most recently, like, I began writing my book, The Slugs, which is on Beelzebub's Tales, and I wrote it initially, I began about 7 years ago, and even at that time, it wasn't until I reread the book most recently that I really comprehended more and more deeply how Beelzebub's teachings about the processes of reciprocal destruction, how his book is about the processes of war.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's a main teaching of Beelzebub's Tales, is like, how are human beings, how are our psyches so degenerate that we periodically engage in these processes of reciprocal self-destruction? And in my first 30 years of studies of the book, I mean, I was aware of that, but I attached little significance to it. But then rereading it in recent times, after I'd kind of woken up to 9/11 and all the deviant things being done politically and internationally, it just revealed a whole other aspect to the book. And all the things he says about the intelligentsia and the plutocrats and the Hasnamus individuals, it's so profound and has such application, I think, to understanding the psychopathology of the world elites. So it's kind of opened up this whole new aspect to the tales that I hadn't been aware of, even though I'd written my book on it. You know, I look back on my first version of the book, and I say the three main areas it covers are, firstly, trying to understand the strange psyche of the three-brained beings on planet Earth, as explained by Beelzebub. So that was a psychopathology of humankind. And then the second aspect is it's an elaboration of what Gurdjieff calls objective science. So Gurdjieff says, for instance, that the law of 3 and 7, or in Beelzebub's, it's called the law of Heptapara Parshanuk and Triamazi Kamno, and that these are cosmic laws that are part of objective science. So, and in Beelzebub, he explains these laws, and he has a model of creation processes based on these principles. So that was the second area of inquiry. And the third area of inquiry in Beelzebub's Tales, it's a model of the science of the soul. And we'll get into this quite a bit today. But Beelzebub teaches that human beings can develop higher being bodies for the life of the soul. And Beelzebub's tales is all about what does this involve and how is that possible and what are these higher being bodies. For me, those three areas were traditionally my interest in the book, and then reading it most recently, it just gives such insights, I think, to understanding the psychopathy of humankind, like looking at the processes of war and all the deviant things being done within our society. And even when we had a very interesting guest last week on who talked about the book Political Ponderology. And I think that was a kind of a classic on trying to understand the psychopathy of the political class. But in a way, I think Beelzebub's tales is even more insightful and useful for us to grasp, like, what is it that's happened on this earth that we've become, you know, we have these horrific processes of reciprocal self-destruction, which in Beelzebub's tales, Beelzebub says that these are unknown in any other solar system in the universe. Like, these are phenomenally depraved processes. So it's an amazing book, Beelzebub's Tales, and I hope we can do some justice to it over the next couple of shows. I'm sure we will.
The book is very good in that sense, in the way that it's told from this, in this peculiar language, and from this alien perspective. And it's looking at these peculiar beings who inhabit the peculiar three-brain beings who inhabit the planet Earth, and the way that he speaks about them creates this distance between everything you take for granted about human beings, and calls it all into question. And when he's talking about their peculiar psyches, he really gives you a sense that people, he says that everything, that we perceive everything topsy-turvy, and that everything is just kind of upside down in terms of the way we understand things. And then when he gets to the process of reciprocal destruction and he talks about it, he shows how, like, we accept war. Like, war is as human as anything, because it runs throughout humanity and humanity's history, and there's always been wars, and people say there always will be wars, but nobody really can explain how wars originate. We have these superficial political, socio-political, historical explanations, but nobody really understands the phenomenon of war, because nobody would, because if people really did understand war, they'd stop it, but they can't stop it. And why can't they stop it? That's part of what Beelzebub really gives you an insight into, is that this is just sort of an automatic manifestation of what it means to be human, and of the psychopathy of human beings, is that we are pathological in terms of our psyches, and only deeply disturbed beings could do this to one another. It's odd, too, because I was just reading today this book called The World According to Washington, An Asian View, a very good book by a Sikh historian, political writer.
A Sikh?
A Sikh.
Sikh. Oh, yeah, of the Sikh religion.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's what I thought you said. I just wasn't sure.
And he's talking about, you know, the aftermath of the, well, he talks about all the Asian wars. He talks about Vietnam, and he talks about what was done during the Vietnam War to Laos and Cambodia. For instance, I think there was something like 1,200 pounds of bombs dropped on every Laotian during the Vietnam War by the American Air Force, even though they weren't really at war with Laos. You know, it was all done in secret and all denied by...
Yeah, it was Henry Kissinger's...
Kissinger. I mean, it's just incredible. Anyway, yes, and then I was reading today the part where he's talking about the after effects of what happened during the first Gulf War. from the depleted uranium that was used there, and all of the poisoning of the food in the water, and the incredible birth defects that have resulted, and the cancer rates that have shot up, and like, you know, something like 500,000 children. Mainly children have been killed as a result of the first Gulf War in Iraq. And at one point, Madeleine Albright, who was Clinton's Secretary of State, was asked, you know, is the death of 500,000 civilians in Iraq, you know, worth it? And she said, from our perspective, it's worth it.
Wow, did she really?
Yeah, she, yeah. Wow. And he talks about it, and he said, you know, he's talking about these birth defects, and he's talking about babies being born without eyes and babies being born without heads, and I mean, just absolutely horrific.
Grotesque, yeah.
And it really struck me again, as like, what kind of, given our discussion last week, is like, what is it in the psyches of human beings that they could actually do this to other human beings and justify it? And you know, I mean, whatever your perspective on the Gulf War is, you know, this is the reality of what people. This is civilians. This isn't even combatants. This is just civilians. But how disturbed do you have to be in your heart to think that that's justified? You know, and for her to, the Secretary of State, you know, wasn't even her war, but I mean, for her to say, oh, well, from our perspective, it's worth it, because they continue the sanctions. They can't even get medicine there to treat cancers, like things that couldn't possibly in any way be dangerous. They're part of the ongoing sanctions, you know, that have been enforced against Iraq. And I just thought, like, when I was reading this, it's like, you know, again, drop all your, whatever your political perspective is, just like try to consider what this is. Like, we're talking about 500,000 people. That's approximately, I don't know what that is. It's like, it's 25, it's 125. Is that right? I think it's 125 9/11s. Roughly, but it's a lot more than you know, there was like 4,000 people killed on 9/11. We're talking about 500,000, mainly civilian, mainly children, and then the ongoing poisoning of the population, you know, and from the use of these shells, and the idea that someone sat around and thought about this, like, you know, like, we could use this waste product from you know, from nuclear processes, and we could put it in weapons.
Yeah,
and they actually did this. It's like, you have to be completely and utterly deranged, and it's only because, you know, people all over the world do this. You know, it's like, this is not an anti-American statement. This is like, people do this everywhere. You know, these types of things. It's just the Americans are more powerful than everybody else, and they have a bigger army, spend more money, more money than the next 25 nations in the world on defense, so-called. It's only because that you know, we've come to accept this, and like, it doesn't matter what we do in terms of improving our weapons. It's just sort of never questioned. But from an outsider's perspective, like from Beelzebub's perspective, and you're looking at these beings, is like, and he says, like, we're the only ones in the universe that do this. You know, like, it really creates this question in the reader's mind, like, what is wrong with people? You know, what? How is this possible? And these are the kind of basic questions that should be asked. As I say, this is beyond any political orientation. I would say it's just like it's not a political question. It's a psychological question. How deformed are people? How delusional? How psychopathic are they that they can sit around and think these things up and then carry out these acts to other human beings? You can't justify
And justify them to
themselves.
And
then justify it and say, you know, like, you're the Secretary of State. Well, do you really think it's worth killing 500,000 civilians in Iraq? From our perspective, it's worth it. Really? Do you understand what you just said? You know, they hung people at the end of the Second World War in Japan for you know, much less than that, you know, or Germans, you know, like, I mean, are you seriously saying that? But, you know, as I say, we're so inured to these outrages that nobody reacts, nobody questions things, or for the most part, nobody reacts or questions things. And again, that's a statement about where we are. For all of our technological sophistication and our intelligence about things, we're on some basic psychological level, there's something seriously lacking with people, you know. And again, that brings us back to Beelzebub, and his explanation is that we perceive reality upside down and topsy-turvy, and I think, you know, the proof is in our behavior. You know, you have to understand that there must be something seriously deformed in the human heart on this planet for these things to occur. And those are just a couple of examples. We could sit here and talk about this for the next 24 hours. You know, we could continually generate examples of this.
Yeah, it's all through human history, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, it's like Beelzebub in the tale says to, no, sorry, Beelzebub's grandson, Hasin, says to Beelzebub at one point, he says, "Grandfather, you know that these stories of wars run like a crimson thread through all your tales. Like, how is this arch criminality? How is this possible?" And that's what the tales does. It kind of gets you to stand back and, like, look at humankind as if you were on the planet Mars and looking objectively without your usual kind of conditioning or perspective, to kind of look at us as a stranger or an alien might look at the human race. It's an astonishing book. So maybe what we can do then is I'll start giving a little bit of an explanation of some of the story, and we'll kind of just go through. I meant to ask him, I noticed in Beelzebub's history, the story opens in, quote, the year 1921 after the birth of Christ. By human calculation,
yeah,
or the year 223 after the creation of the world, according to objective time calculation. And I think, was 1921 the year that Gurdjieff began to write the tales? I was wondering what year his accident was. To just give a little bit of history to the tales, like, at the time Gurdjieff began to write the book, it was after he had a very serious car accident in France, and he had an institute which was running at the time and had dozens of students. It was called the Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man. And he had then this very serious accident and then couldn't maintain the institute. And in a way, it's like, I think he sent a lot of his students away. And he felt that his life work, he had to take a different angle on it. And so for 7 years, he worked at producing Beelzebub's tales, which I understood he finished in 7 years, even though he then continued to revise it over the next 20 to 30 years until his death in 1949, because he used to read chapters of it to his group, like in Paris after the war, which would have been put him into the late 1940s. He would have readings of Beelzebub's tales. And I think Gurdjieff worked at the book right up until his death. I don't think it was set too early. But I was wondering, do you know, was 1921 the date of his accident? Because it's interesting in the tales that in the first chapter, it tells you that that's the date, 1921.
Yeah, no. I'm just looking here in Patterson's book, Struggle of Magicians. My gut tells me it was July 1924 that he had the accident. I'm almost positive it was 1924. But I think 21, I think he was still in Constantinople in 21. I think that he didn't get to Paris until 22, but... Yeah, but I'm almost positive that I'm just looking... it's like, because it says July 24 he's recovering, and that was that was from the accident, I think.
July of 1924.
I'm just trying to find. He came back to France in June of 24. I'm almost sure it was like June or July, but I know that the accident wasn't in 1921. It was later than that for sure.
Yeah.
It was. I'm almost positive. Oh yeah. Okay. Here it is. It was in the July 8th, 1924.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, it's odd that 21. What's the significance of 21? I think maybe 21 might mark his decision to go to the West.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think that might be it, because I think up until that point he was still contemplating, you know, trying to decide where he was going to go. He was looking around at England, and he couldn't get into England. And he was looking at Germany. And then he ended up settling in France. But I think he was also considering going to the East. He wasn't really quite sure what he was going to do. And so that may well be that for him was kind of a birthing point in sense of his own mission, a transition point. That's when he made his break from, because he had intended to stay in Russia. He had no intention really ever of leaving Russia, I don't think. I think that was the Western venue that he'd chosen, was he would go to Moscow and St. Petersburg, and then the revolution broke out and he had to leave. But I think that may be what that represents. It's his birthing point. But it's not when he decided to write, for sure. Well, it's not ostensibly when he decided to write, because he always said it was the accident that caused him to take up writing, which he said he didn't want to do. So,
Okay, so the setting of the book is what I'm going to do as we go through it. As we go through the tales, at times I'm going to say quote, and when I say quote, I'm quoting Gurdjieff's terms, because in the tales, Gurdjieff has a very eccentric language, but he's a wordsmith. And sometimes his language is so brilliant. So at times when I speak, if you hear me say quote, you know, what I'm doing is quoting his exact terminology and words. And I won't always finish and say unquote. Sometimes I may just quote, but I think through the emphasis of my voice, you'll be able to see when the quote has finished. Okay, so the setting of the tales, they are recounted as Beelzebub is on a spaceship. And the spaceship, it's called a trans-spaceship, Karnak. And they're under a large, quote, glass bell. So you might imagine Beelzebub, his grandson, and his servant, Ahun, who has been his servant through his time in our solar system. So Ahun has witnessed many of the tales that Gurdjieff is recounting. Now, as the story occurs, long, long before, as a youth on his home planet of Karatus, Beelzebub had an extraordinarily resourceful intelligence, and was taken into service on the Sun Absolute as an attendant upon his endlessness. So initially, Beelzebub had been like an archangel or a higher being who was in service of what Gurdjieff calls the Most Holy Sun Absolute. Unfortunately, because of a certain misunderstanding due to his youth and impetuous mentation, Beelzebub, quote, saw in the government of the world, unquote, something which seemed, quote, illogical to him. And he gained support for his views among some comrades, also youthful and not yet fully formed, and then, quote, interfered in what was none of his business. So the storyline is that Beelzebub was this kind of higher cosmic individual who, because of his youth, had interfered, and he then was exiled because he almost called it rebellion. It draws to mind the kind of rebellion of Lucifer, I guess, a Jim who's kind of kicked, sent into exile.
Yeah.
And so similarly, Beelzebub is sent into exile, and he is exiled to the planet, the solar system of Ors, spelled O-R-S. And I don't know, I think that for Gurdjieff meant like ours, like Ors.
Yeah.
Is that how you take that?
Yeah, that's how I take it, too. It's like,
it's so
close to ours. And in a way, it's a little joke. I mean, he does this all the time. It's like, ours, you know, like a solar system, our, like we could have a solar system, you know, and the, kind of the investment of our ego in these things, you know, our solar system. So I think that a lot of things like that are kind of premised on that idea, is that we sort of appropriate things all the time, so I think you're right.
Okay, so, and then when he's assigned to live on the planet Mars, and he settles there, he comes to the solar system with a number of his attendants and assembly, and they set up a colony on the planet Mars. And while he's there, Gurdjieff builds a major telescope there. And a friend of his who lives on the planet Saturn helps him revise his telescope, that he ends up with one of the most famous telescopes in the universe, which can magnify a phenomena 7,028 times. So he's got this telescope set up on the planet Mars. And when Beelzebub first establishes a colony on Mars, the Earth has not yet formed, and it's not concentrated even. So he's supposed to have existed on the planet Mars for many centuries before any known history. And he settled there with his kinsmen. Now, what happens then, and I'm going to tell a little bit of this background of his history to the solar system. He says that a planet, a condor, collides with the Earth in prehistory, and it breaks off two fragments of the Earth. And one of these becomes our moon, and the other, he says, there's a secondary moon which is unknown to modern science. But this is a much smaller moon, and he describes it as having a very eccentric orbit. So he says there's really two moons, but we only know of one of them. And what happens is after this comet hits the Earth and breaks off the moons, and then the moon flies out, it's projected from the Earth, but then he says it takes a time for the moon to settle back into orbit. So there's a period of adjustment before, according to what he calls the law of catching up, that the moon kind of falls back into the place where its natural center of gravity is. So what happens is he says, after the moon is ejected, when it settles back into its natural orbit around the Earth, this causes a major disruption on the Earth, which causes another catastrophe on Earth, which he says is the sinking of the continent of Atlantis. And then Gurdjieff, when he's living on Mars, he lives on Mars for thousands of years, and in the book, he visits Earth on 6 occasions, and the first visit is during the time of Atlantis. So Gurdjieff visits for the first time during the period of Atlantis, and then he goes back to the planet of Mars, and then the second catastrophe happens, which is where the moon falls back into orbit, and there's a displacement again, which causes stresses on the Earth, and the submersion of Atlantis, and new land masses rise. So after the second catastrophe, you see, the first catastrophe was a collision of a comet with the Earth, and the second was the moon falling back into its orbit, which caused the drowning of Atlantis. And then Beelzebub visits twice after the downing of Atlantis, And he visits then parts of what would now be called Asia. And he visits what he calls the city of Gob, spelt G-O-B. That's one of the places he visits, which he later says, because of a third set of catastrophes that happens to the earth, where there are great winds, and these winds wear down certain parts of the mountains, and they fill in certain depressions on the earth, so it creates huge deserts. And where in his second visit, he visits, or the third visit, actually, it's the country, the city of Gob. And later, that is covered over by sands, and it forms the Gobi Desert. So the Gobi Desert is currently in Upper China and Mongolia. So his second visit was, he says, like by his fourth visit, the countries he had visited during his second and third visits were wiped out. They were covered with sands. So it's like he gives you a cosmic perspective of how he comes down on Earth at different times in human history where the terrain has completely changed. Okay, so he visits first during Atlantis, then twice, two visits before you have the third cosmic catastrophe, which is these unprecedented winds, which causes different deserts to form and a great transmigration of races. So Gurdjieff gives this kind of cosmic history, which is the background to his six visits to the planet Earth. His fifth visit was at the period of Babylon, where the city of Babylon is the center of culture. Okay, and like that, I would think that we would place back 2,500 to 3,000 years ago, approximately. I'm not sure when they date the city of Babylon to. Among his visits, Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's sixth visit to the planet Earth, it is his longest visit, and on that occasion, he stays on the Earth for 300 years. But he explains that 300 human years make up only 1 year of his time. And during his sixth visit, which is the visit he explains most and he tells the most stories about, he visits Egypt. Well, he lands in Afghanistan, actually. He lands in Afghanistan, and he lands on a spaceship called the Occasion. And he says that they can make the spaceship Occasion, they can make it invisible to human perception, to visual perception, but he explains that they can't annihilate its presence. So when he comes back for his sixth visit, he says by then there are so many ships flitting around on the seas that they can't moor their spaceship in the water, so they have to take the spaceship up and they moor it at the North Pole, and then while Beelzebub spends 300 years on the Earth. So it's his sixth visit to the Earth, which is during the modern era. His accounts of those times being in America, in the book Beelzebub's Tales, he travels to America on a steamship, which is just as Mr. Gurdjieff did around the year 1921. In that period, I would say, Jim, that he traveled to America on a steamship?
Yeah, he was back and forth several times in the 20s, early 20s.
Yeah. So during his last visit, the point is, he's talking about the period in which he lived in Europe, and he visits Russia. He talks about being in France, and when he visits France, he hangs out at the cafes of Paris, which is what Mr. Gurdjieff did himself. It was supposed to be his other office, with these cafes. And what was the famous cafe, Jim, that he used to
Café de la Paix outside the Paris Opera House, across from the Paris Opera House, where I've actually sat and paid a lot of money for a cup of coffee.
Oh, you went there when you were in Paris?
Yeah, I sat on the terrace because I was looking for the hookers, because he used to talk about that AFI. But I didn't see any. And New York, he used to go to Child's Coffee Shop in Columbus Circle, was his New York office. That's what he used to call these cafes, his New York or his Paris office, where he would sit and write and observe people.
Yeah, in his tales, when he visits the Earth, on most of his visits, what Beelzebub would do would be to go to the local bar or restaurants or cafes in order to meet and study the beings there.
Yeah.
So it's very similar to what Gurdjieff himself did, the way he set up office on the streets of Paris.
Yeah. One thing, I just on the 1921 thing, Chris, I was just noticing that really, 21's the time when Uspensky and Gurdjieff sort of split, and so that may be it, that, you know, he's talking about that's when the genesis of a new type of writing actually began for him, because then he lost Uspensky, who was going to present, you know, his work in a certain way, even though Uspensky hadn't started writing about him, but, you know, Gurdjieff knew that he was going to write about him for sure, because he sort of selected Uspensky on that basis, and so it may be that, you know, he gave his first talk in Europe in November or December in Berlin, in the West, so that may be it too, that seems to have been a transition point for him in terms of this whole new aspect of his teaching, so that might explain the choice of 1921.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, that would make sense. I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so that the storyline then is that Beelzebub is this character banished to our solar system. He's living on the planet Mars, and he visits human. He visits the planet Earth six times during his centuries on the planet Mars. Now, by the end of his book, he has been pardoned for his youthful indiscretions, and he's allowed to return to his planet of Caratus, where he was born. So he's allowed to return there because of his service to our endlessness. And his service was in terms of his visits to the Earth and his helping with the work of Ashiash Shimash, who is a character who we will come to as we go through the tales. So at the end of the story, Beelzebub has been pardoned, and so he returns to his planet, home planet, and when he arrives there, he's asked to go to another solar system, the solar system of the Pole Star, where there's a conference on. So he's traveling there on his spaceship. And when he returns to the planet Caratus, he meets his grandson, Hassin. So when he is going to this conference in this other solar system, he takes his grandson with him. And because it's a long trip, he then begins to recount his visits to the planet Earth, trying to explain these things to his grandson. And his grandson is very interested in these creatures, these strange three-brained beings on planet Earth. And Beelzebub recognizes his grandson's intrigue by these creatures. And he always refers to those three-brained beings on planet Earth as, quote, your favorites. Which is very cute, because he's talking to Hassin and he's saying, like, your favorites, those three-brained beings on planet Earth. But it also works very effective as a literary device, because he's talking about your favorites, which is us. So it is like talking about us, as your favorites. It's a very...
It's two-pronged, because on the one hand, it's like that, you know, this kid has this fascination, you know, with human beings, whom he refers to at one point as slugs, and they become your favorites. But it's like he's, you know, it's just something he's fascinated by, like, you know, like kids play with, have, you know, rocks, collect rocks, you know, or have ant farms or whatever, you know, like it's, you know, it trivializes human beings on the one level, but we still are his favorites. And then it's us, too, at the same time. It's like we're our own favorites, you know, like we think we're so special and we're so fantastic. So he's really having a good time, like, pointing out kind of the absurdity of our human egocentrism and narcissism, in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's a neat element in the book how he is your favorite. So it's like
us. And he does
that
all the time with human, when he's referring to humans. Eh? He repeatedly does that throughout the books about how much we love ourselves and you know, and I mean it's very childish. I mean it you get the sense of how childish it is and how it, you know, it's not really becoming of somebody who's really fully developed. But
yeah. Okay, and so through the story, there are different reasons for Beelzebub's trip to the Earth. The first one is at the time of Atlantis. Okay, actually, I should step back a moment and tell a little bit more about the history. After the disruption of the cosmic harmony because the comet hit the Earth and broke off the moon, and the moon wasn't yet stabilized in its orbit. And then there was a special commission, that a higher commission, which came to the solar system and landed on the planet Mars because they were concerned of how this cosmic disruption could affect the larger universe or solar system. And they decided that They had to make it so that organic life on Earth would provide or produce certain what are called Skokan vibrations, and that these vibrations produced by organic life on Earth would help to maintain the moon in its orbit. So now, this is very odd. Gurdjieff, in the Uspenskian version, he says that when any organic being dies, a certain soul energy or certain vital energy passes to the moon. Okay, so Gurdjieff actually talks about feeding the moon. But he says when organic life forms die, a certain soul energy passes to the moon. So the death of creatures on Earth provides these Ahsokan vibrations which maintain the evolution of the moon. Now, Gurdjieff or Beelzebub explains that these creatures, they didn't realize at the time that their life and death was only for the purposes of feeding the moon. So in order for humankind not to understand their enslavement by the moon, this higher commission planted in human beings the organ kund buffer, which is supposed to be at the root of the spine, where the tail was. And this organ kunda buffer is said to have two particular effects on their psyche of the three-brained beings. One is that it makes them perceive reality topsy-turvy, like meaning seeing it upside down or taking the ephemeral for the real. So it's like the organ kunda buffer causes them not to perceive reality. And the second effect of the organ kunda buffer is that it causes them to be conditioned by the sensations of pleasure. So that human beings, they're conditioned by the sensations of pleasure. so that people become preoccupied with the seeking of pleasure. Now, what happens, this organ Kunda buffer, according to the story, is only implanted in human beings for a certain period of time, and it has these unusual effects on the psyche of human beings. But then the organ is rendered, it's no longer necessary, so it's removed, again, by another high commission. But what happens is, even after the organ Kunda buffer is removed, the three-brained beings on planet Earth are still affected by its consequences. Because the effect of the organ Kunda buffer is such on their psyche that these effects become habitual or automated, and then they're passed from generation to generation. So all the time in the book, Beelzebub is explaining, he has this phrase where he talks about the crystallization of the properties of the organ Kunda buffer. So even though the Kunda buffer organ is removed, it had certain effects on the psyche of humankind, which became crystallized in their presences and then passed from generation to generation. Okay, let me just... So he's always talking about the consequences of the properties of the organ Kunda buffer. And it's very interesting. He says, I'm going to quote a little bit what he says about the organ Kunda buffer. But one of the things he says about it that's very interesting. At one point, Beelzebub notes that the chemical substance cocaine has an effect on the psyche of the contemporary beings of the planet Earth, surprisingly similar to that which the famous organ Kunda buffer had on the psyche of their ancestors. Now, I think what he's trying to get at here is the effect of cocaine on someone is to enhance their false ego, their self-centeredness, their absorption by pleasure, grandiosity in people. So Beelzebub's saying that the effect of the organ Kunda buffer is similar to the drug of cocaine on people. And then in the book, what he is explaining is how a false consciousness system became crystallized in the presences of three-brained beings on planet Earth. And he says that their real consciousness, or what should be their real consciousness, passes into their subconscious. So they form this false consciousness system. And in a way, the way to understand that is what this false consciousness system is false ego in people. And whereas the real self passes into what we call our subconscious. And Beelzebub says in the real consciousness, for instance, are the impulses of what he calls the sacred being impulses of faith, hope, love, and conscience. So he's saying that these higher emotions pass into the subconscious, and humankind, they form this false ego, which comes to dominate them more and more and causes their abnormalities, all the different kinds of abnormalities we'll come to. So that's a little bit of why human beings perceive reality topsy-turvy and how we no longer feel these divine impulses of faith, hope, and love. Okay, so during his time on Mars, Beelzebub visits the Earth, usually has an assignment. The first time he has to help out because a countryman of his on the continent of Atlantis, he befriends the king of Atlantis. And this king is supposed to be a very fair and just king, and he takes taxes and demands labor of his subjects in his kingdom in order to maintain the realm of Atlantis. But Beelzebub's countrymen thinks that this is unconscionable, that the king uses threats to an intimidation to keep his subjects in line. And Beelzebub's kinsman persuades the king of Atlantis to no longer use threats or menaces in order to get his taxes and aid from the subjects in his kingdom. And the king then agrees to do that. They make a wager, which Beelzebub's kinsman signs in his blood, that if the subjects don't pay into the treasury, well, then he'll make up the difference. And then what happens is, once the subjects aren't forced by threat and menace to pay their taxes, people no longer pay their taxes. And Beelzebub says, not only do they not pay their taxes, but they even begin stealing from the treasury and taking back what they had contributed before. Now, part of the idea of this story is that Beelzebub's kinsmen hadn't recognized that the three-brained beings on planet Earth no longer had this function of conscience in them. So if they could not work, I'm trying to find the quote here where he explains this exactly. Just a second. Okay, here's what he says. One of the consequences of the organ, which has already become thoroughly crystallized in the number of beings there, was the consequence of the property which, while the organ Kundabuffer itself was still functioning in them, had enabled them very easily and without any remorse of conscience not to carry out voluntarily any duties taken upon themselves or given them by a superior. But every duty they fulfilled was fulfilled only from the fear and apprehension of threats and menaces from outside. See, Beelzebub is saying that human beings normally they would assume a certain responsibility in paying taxes and contributing to the kingdom. But because of the effects of the organ Kundabuffer, the people were then only selfishly based. So they didn't strive to fulfill what Gurdjieff calls the being partgedolj duty, which is like your being obligations. So it was no, and Gurdjieff's kinsmen didn't understand this about the strange three-brained beings on planet Earth. He thought, well, like, it would just be normal that people would want to contribute to the upkeep of the kingdom. He thought the king was unconscionable because he used threats and menace, but that was unnecessary. So the kinsmen had misjudged what the effects of the organ Kundabuffer were on the three-brained beings on planet Earth. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the things that keeps recurring in the book, and this tale is a nice illustration of it, is that higher intelligence and forces continually try to reach human beings, but they're not. First of all, higher intelligences are not fallible. Beelzebub is a higher intelligence, and he stuck his nose into something that wasn't his business, and he screwed up. And continually, they're trying to help human beings, but there's repeated references to his endlessness, who's this omniscient intelligence God, but between God and everything in creation, there's a distance, and there are all things, sorts of things fail, and all sorts of accidents happen, and all sorts of things have unintended consequences. So there's this constant accidental happenings and circumstantial happenings and unforeseen consequences that go on in both human and in cosmic history. So it's not like this pervasive intelligence which can just fix everything. So I think that's one of the really interesting aspects of this that he keeps describing. And this is a nice example. It's like, well, when you're dealing with humans, you have to realize that they don't respond the way that other, you know, properly centered beings do in the universe.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what Beelzebub's kinsmen didn't understand.
Yeah.
So then what happened, the subject stopped paying taxes, and then Beelzebub's kinsmen, he had to start using his wealth to make up the difference, and then all the kinsmen of Beelzebub's tribe, and then they soon used up all their resources, and they still needed more money to maintain the kingdom. So then Beelzebub was asked to visit the earth to help them resolve this difficulty. And what happened, Beelzebub visits and they hold a council and they decide that what they're going to have to do is the subjects are bound to rebel once the king again tries to force taxes upon his subjects. So what they do is they recognize that the subjects are going to be angry at the king and at his administration. So they replace the people, the power-possessing beings, with members of Beelzebub's own tribe, and then when they bring the taxes back, the hostility of the people is taken out against Beelzebub's kinsmen, and there's a revolution in the kingdom, but eventually they're able to return to the previous arrangement of the king in regards to collecting taxes. So the king is put back into office. It's a very odd tale. Like, I know the first time I read it, what is the point of that? It's somewhat peculiar, but it begins to show you the effects of the organ Kunda buffer on those strange three-brained beings.
Yeah, and I think part of it, too, is that, as you say, it's like Gurdjieff elaborates later on what the five essential being obligations are and what being duties are, and he says these are obligations that that are proper to any being who's striving for perfection and who's properly centered and who's got some sort of minimal contact with reality. And I think what this example shows is kind of how social and political systems, which perhaps objectively don't make any sense, get imposed upon people and get created and maintain themselves because people are not properly psychologically grounded and are not properly conscious and don't have the proper strivings. And because they perceive reality topsy-turvy, then they end up in these peculiar social and political systems that, in a sense, don't make objective sense, but only do make sense in terms of because they're dealing with humans. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, because of the psychopathology of the human psyche.
Psychopathology of human beings. Yeah, it's like you have a psychopathology of the political and social systems. Because he comes back to this again and again, is how every time anything that really there's a step forward, things seem to go sideways because of the psychopathology of human beings. And as I say, it can't be just, this is like another sort of skeptical objection to the idea of the existence of God. Well, if God's perfect, why doesn't God just fix everything, you know? And why is there any suffering or anything? And it's like, well, no. God is perfect, but God exists on another level, and God doesn't. There are different gradations between God and other beings in the universe, such as human beings, and there are all sorts of degrees of fallibility in between the lowest beings and the highest beings, and that's what you see over and over again in the tales. Is like, you know, things happen, mistakes are made.
Mm-hmm.
Even by the most well-intentioned, I think that's what that first tale is. This higher being's well-intentioned, and from his perspective, is doing everything is according to objective reason. This isn't necessary. He intervenes, and then he finds out he fails because he doesn't understand the lower levels that he's dealing with.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, it's explained his youth and impetuous mentation kind of led him to, he thought he saw an injustice in how the kingdom was being run, but it was really just due to his youthfulness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so Beelzebub's second visit was 11 centuries later, after the submerging of the continent of Atlantis. And this time, he does his second and third trips to the Earth are both to try to reduce the number of animal sacrifices being conducted on Earth because of all the strange religions that have formed. And in these strange religions, the people kind of think that it pleases God to sacrifice these one and two-brained beings to the gods. And these sacrificial offerings are so widespread that, again, it's producing low-quality Ascoken vibrations for feeding the moon. So it's threatening to adversely influence the formation of the moon's atmosphere and the evolution of the moon as a planet. So Gurdjieff's second and third trips to the Earth are to try to reduce animal sacrifices as being conducted in different religions. Okay, and his fourth trip then, after being successful in accomplishing his task, he returns to the live on planet Mars, and it's centuries before again when he comes back. And again, the next time in his fourth visit, he visits the continent of Africa, or he visits Egypt. And he goes to Egypt because a question has arisen as to the origins of apes. And Beelzebub has decided to come to the planet Earth to retrieve some apes, which he then takes back to the planet Saturn, where his friend lives, where they can do some elucidating experiments with the apes. And the idea is that they want to know whether man came from apes or apes came from man. And so they're interested in the derivation of the apes. And while he's there in his fourth visit, he's in the, they're building the Sphinx and the pyramids at that time in Egypt. And Beelzebub explains that in the ancient times in Atlantis, there was a genuine esoteric society called the Akaldan Society of genuine initiates. And that these genuine initiates, they had a party pythoness who foretold the submersion of Atlantis. So various members of this ancient mystical brotherhood had left Egypt before the downing of Atlantis, and many of them had settled into Egypt. And so after the third catastrophe in the solar system, which had to do with the great winds and the formation of deserts and the great transmigration of races. So Beelzebub visits and he observes the building of the pyramids and the Sphinx. And he says, when he sees the Sphinx, he says that the Sphinx was a copy, a replica of the statue that they had in Atlantis in front of the temple for this mystical Akaldan brotherhood in Atlantis. So he's saying that the Sphinx originates from Atlantis. And in Atlantis, he says the Sphinx, that statue, was called Conscience. Okay, it's also interesting, he describes the pyramids as poor observation of distant cosmic phenomena and the observation of the heavens and such. But he also says of the pyramids that they were designed as a way of controlling and affecting the weather. I had never realized that before, Jim. That was something
I didn't know that at all.
Because when I read that, I thought, wow, what an interesting concept. It reminded me, many years ago, I'd visited Ted Mann, who had been a professor who wrote an excellent book on Wilhelm Reich. It was called Reich, Orgone, Reich, and Eros.
Yeah.
And he was a foremost expert on Wilhelm Reich. And I visited Ted Mann at his farm down by Picton area in Ontario. And he had his Cloudbuster out there. And I remember seeing his Cloudbuster, and it was very, very simple. Eh? It was mainly just like about a 15-foot-long metal cylinder with a cable which led down to running water. And Ted Mann was out there kind of trying to bust clouds or accumulate or create rain using these cloud busters of his. And when I thought, wow, what a concept that the pyramids somehow were supposed to be involved in weather modification. So a very interesting claim. I mean, you wonder about Gurdjieff back in the 1920s, even having that concept of humankind controlling the weather, because in our age there's more and more claims that this is what's being done through the HAARP program, and in modern times that the military is talking about this now, the control of the weather even as a weapon. And it just saw a report of how it was used in the Vietnam War, that they caused rain on the Ho Chi Minh Trail to kind of prevent the weapons from being brought down through the mountains. So there is evidence that we've been subject to weather modification for decades, however extensive that might be. But I was shocked a little bit that even back in the 1920s, Gurdjieff claimed that of the pyramids. Anyway, so during this visit to the planet Earth, he wants to find out about the origin of these apes. And I'm going to just read a few quotes here. One thing he's saying about some of the effects of the Orgone Kunda buffer had on your favorites has to do with this impulse of pleasure. And Beelzebub explains, quote, "This impulse is now called pleasure, and in order to satisfy it, they had already begun to exist in ways unbecoming to three-centered beings. Namely, most of them gradually began to remove this same sacred being substance from themselves only for the satisfaction of the said impulse." Now, here what he's... I missed an earlier quote. He's talking about the substance he calls exohere, or as your favorites would call it, sperm. This sperm is described as, quote, "the final result of the evolving transformations of every kind of being food formed in the presence of every being." And if you're familiar with the Uspenskian version of the Gurdjieff teaching, Gurdjieff regarded human beings as having three major being foods. The first is physical food and water, which sustains the planetary body. And the second being food is air. And Gurdjieff says not only in air is there the oxygen in the air, but there's also radiations in the air, because the planets and the sun seem to affect the quality of the radiations present in their second being food. And the third being food for Uspensky is psychological impressions. that all the time we're gaining sensory input from the external world, and we're fed by that sensory input, so psychological impressions. And in the Uspensky explanation of the Gurdjieff teachings, he explains how each of these being foods comes into the organism, and within the organism, it's refined through a series of alchemical processes in the body, and that these three being foods come to produce all the different energies required for the functioning of the body, and also, Gurdjieff says, for the higher being bodies. Like the air, Gurdjieff says, is mainly responsible for feeding and of the astral body. And the third being food is related to the third being body, the mental body, even though he doesn't use that term. So what he's saying in this quote, like when Gurdjieff has then what he calls the food diagrams, how these different being foods come into the organism, they're refined within the organism. And he's saying that sperm is like the ultimate result of all this alchemical processes in the material body by which we take in raw materials, and the end product is this sperm. And he says, this sacred substance arises in beings chiefly in order that by its means they might consciously or automatically fulfill that part of their being duty which consists in the continuation of their species. But in the presences of three-brained beings, it arises also in order that it might be consciously transformed in their common presences for coding their highest being body for their own being. So Gurdjieff explains that sperm is not only for the continuation of the race, but he's saying it's the accumulation and transformation of sexual substances that allows for the formation and crystallization of the higher being bodies. So the sperm isn't only for continuation of our species, but it also allows a person to develop their astral body and their mental body. So sperm is regarded as a very sacred substance. And what Beelzebub is explaining here is after one of the effects of the organ kunda buffer is that people all the time were removing this sperm from themselves only for the sensation of pleasure, and that they didn't realize that this was depleting their vital energies, and the consequence of it was they weren't developing their higher being bodies. And so all the time they're wasting their sexual energies simply for the experience of pleasure. Okay, so anyway, coming back, the fourth trip when Beelzebub visits, he's in Egypt, and he's wondering about the origin of apes. And he explains here that at the time, while he's on the spaceship, he gets an etherogram, which is very like a telegram, except it's an etherogram, like a telegram that's transmitted through the ether. And he's informed that the issue has just arisen again on the Earth as to the origins of the apes. And so he begins to explain to his grandson where apes came from. And I'll go through a little bit of this. Explains what he says, even before Atlantis, your favorites were not in the habit of utilizing sperm for the purpose of coding their higher being bodies. Okay, so what happened is after the second or the third major catastrophe, some beings survived, but he said they had to exist without members of the opposite sex, and they began to turn to various anti-natural means for the removal from themselves of this sacred substance, Exioheri. And then he explains they turned to onanism, which is a term for masturbation, and pederasty, or intercourse with children. Okay, so what he's saying is after a lot of beings were isolated on the continent of Africa without partners of the opposite sex, and he says that the males turned to masturbation and pederasty, and then he says, but for the three-brained beings of the passive sex, or as they are called, women, the said anti-natural methods proved not to be sufficiently satisfying. And so the poor women orphans of that time, already then more cunning and inventive than the men there, began to seek out and accustom beings of other forms of the given place to be their partners. So what Gurdjieff actually suggests is the apes originated from a women having sexual experience with animals, and that was the origin of the apes. It's an all very peculiar section to his writing, and it's hard to know if he's being serious or he's being sarcastic. He quotes at one point, he says, oh, you always have to understand. In fact, neither have they descended from apes, nor have apes descended from them, but the cause of the origin of these apes is, in this case, just as in every other misunderstanding, they're also their women. So Beelzebub explains that there are now a great many species of generation of ape beings, each bearing a very definite resemblance to some form of a two-brained quadruple being still existing there, not only in facial features, but in psychic features. And then it reads, Beelzebub then made a long pause and looking at his favorite Hossein with a smile, which very clearly expressed a double meaning. And I'm not sure really what the double meaning of that whole story. Very odd story of the origin of apes. But then Beelzebub goes on and he's saying how the new scientists there, they were going to Africa. They want to get some more apes to run them in their experimentation. And he says about how the apes will very much cooperate with this because of they love the titillation, he says. So it's like the image of all these scientists bringing these apes over. And you know how monkeys are, like the kind of titillation. I don't know. I'm not sure what I'm trying to get at. He compares them with women and how they'll enjoy being subject to these experimentations because it'll allow them all these forms of titillation. It's a very peculiar story. Anyway, I'm going to move on to Beelzebub's fifth descent to the planet Earth. And this was at the time of Atlantis. And during his time on Mars, Beelzebub deliberately kept these beings under observation in order to clear up in his mentation all the particularities in their manifestations. He is wondering what could be their psychic experiencings. So he observes them from the planet Earth. He says, further, there were innumerable illnesses on the earth, but the worst horror of all was those ongoing processes of reciprocal destruction, which is his term for war or revolution, and where you have slaughtage and pillage. And Beelzebub says, I must first tell you that the chief peculiarity of the psyche of your favorites, namely the periodic need to destroy the existence of others like oneself, interested me more and more with each succeeding century of theirs. And side by side with it, the irresistible desire increased in me to find out the exact causes of a particularity so phenomenal for three-brained beings. So this is the reason he again comes to the visits the earth, is to understand again the causes of war. The trips before were to help stop animal sacrifices, which were producing so much poor quality Ascolcan vibrations. But this time it was the processes of war which are disrupting the cosmic harmony. And he at this point, he came to Babylon. And he says, at Babylon was flourishing at the time, and there were a great many learned beings there who had been gathered by a most peculiar Persian king. This king was obsessed with the possession of that popular metal called gold. Further, the established custom there on earth was, quote, never to consider through what kind of being manifestations he becomes the possessor of a great quantity of this metal. Okay, so he's saying, yeah, the beings who want this gold, it doesn't matter what you have to do to get it. What is important is to get it. And after a process of reciprocal destruction had run its course, Beelzebub says, a king conqueror would be able to take from the conquered all their lands, young beings of the female sex, and all the riches accumulated by people during centuries. However, this king, conqueror, was very different in that he chose instead to capture only the learned beings of the conquered communities. And the reason for this was because there had been another Hasnamassian individual who had invented the idea that any old metal could be turned into the metal gold if one knew, quote, just one very small secret. Okay, this definite, maleficent, fantastic science arose under the name alchemy, the same name as used in a prior epoch for a great science which had indeed existed and which might still be useful and indeed necessary for the three-brained beings there, even of contemporary times. Okay, so this Persian king, he wanted a great deal of this gold, so he decided, so when he conquered these territories, he brought all these learned beings from all over the earth, from the territories he conquered, he brought them all to Babylon and wanted them to reveal this secret. He began, though, he took all the learned beings of Babylon, and he said, when not a single one of the learned of the whole community knew this little secret of how to turn metal into gold, the king began to examine them, quote, after the manner that has already long before been the way of power-possessing beings to examine ordinary beings. Do you grasp that, Jim, what he's saying? Yeah, that's so. In my writing, I say when such torture produced no result. Like that's what he's saying. After the manner that had already long before been the way of power-possessing beings, and ordinary beings. Okay, so his torture didn't produce any results. So then the king turned to military excursions, to countries, to seize by force the learned beings of other communities. And he brought these beings to Babylon. And that's why all these learned beings were assembled in the city of Babylon during Beelzebub's visit. We had a beep there. I didn't know. Was there someone calling in? Or had you heard that, Jim?
I didn't hear it.
Oh, okay. So maybe just on my phone.
Oh, but is there
okay.
Someone...
Okay. As it happens, the king soon tired of his determination to discover the little secret of alchemy, as he had indeed become consumed by that other chief peculiarity of the human psyche. Quote, when a little later a fresh craze arose in the presence of this peculiar Persian king, the craze for the process itself of the destruction of the existence of other beings similar to himself, and which supplanted the former craze. He forgot about the learned beings, and they began to exist there freely in the city of Babylon, awaiting his further directions. So the king lost his interest in alchemy, and he became more enamored by the processes of reciprocal destruction. So then you had all these learned beings in the city of Babylon. And it was at this time that the burning issue of the day became that concerning the existence of the human soul. And I'll just read some of from Beelzebub here, just to give an example of the type of language of Gurdjieff and some of his humor. He says, "The learned beings collected there in the city of Babylon from almost the whole of the planet used often to meet together and, of course, to discuss among themselves, as is proper to the learned beings of the planet Earth, questions which were either immeasurably beyond their comprehension or about which they could never elucidate anything useful whatsoever, either for themselves or for ordinary beings there. Well, it was just during these meetings and discussions that there arose among them, as it is in general proper to arise among learned beings there, what is called a burning question of the day, a question which in some way or other indeed at that time to, as they say, their very marrow. The question which chanced to become the burning question of the day so vitally touched the whole being of every one of them, that they even climbed down from their what are called pedestals and began discussing it not only with the learned like themselves, but also here, there, and everywhere with anyone they chanced to meet. It was talked about and discussed by the young and old, by men and women, and even by the Babylonian butchers. Exceedingly anxious were they, particularly the learned, to know about this question. After our arrival there, many of the beings existing in Babylon had ultimately even lost their reason on account of this question, and many were already candidates for losing theirs. The burning question of the day was that both the sorry learned and also the ordinary beings of the city of Babylon were very interested to know whether they had a soul. Every kind of fantastic theory existed in Babylon about this question, and more theories were being freshly cooked up, and every, as it is said there, catchy theory had, of course, its followers. Although whole hosts of these various theories existed there, nevertheless, they were one and all based on only two opposite assumptions. One of these was called the atheistic and the other the idealistic or dualistic. All the dualistic theories maintained the existence of the soul and, of course, its immortality, and every possible kind of perturbation to it after the death of the being man. And all the atheistic theories maintained just the opposite. In short, my boy, when we arrived in the city of Babylon, there was then proceeding what is called the building of the Tower of Babel. Okay, so here the idea is this issue of the soul had become so, had taken Babylon, and everyone was discussing it, and what's interesting is, see, in Gurdjieff's teaching, it is really neither atheistic nor dualistic. Instead, it's somewhere in between, because in the normal dualistic theory, it's assumed that everybody has a soul, that everybody has this dual nature, and everybody has a soul, and all the different things can happen to your soul after death. Okay. Well, Beelzebub teaches that although a human being can attain their soul, it isn't an automatic process, and that a person has to strive to attain their soul. So he says that human beings can refine their higher being bodies and attain these higher being bodies, but unless they make particular being efforts and fulfill their part kadosh duty, then that possibility is never actualized. Okay, so hard to give a sense of these tales. Yes, Beelzebub says, yes, on almost all the planets of that solar system also, three-brained beings dwell, and in almost all of them, higher being bodies can be coded. Higher being bodies, or as they are called on some planets of that solar system, souls arise in the three-brained beings. Okay, so it's a... All Gurdjieff stories are peculiar. Some of them are like almost absurd, the funny things that happen. But partly here the idea is that in the ancient time of Babylon, they began all the learned beings to create all these fanciful theories about the soul. And what Beelzebub is saying, none of them understood the necessity of attaining your soul. People thought either an atheistic view that you had no soul, or a dualistic view and everybody has a soul, whereas Gurdjieff says that we have to attain our soul. And I notice we're coming down to just a couple minutes left, so we'll have to leave it at this today and try to pick up next week in explaining some of Beelzebub's psychology of humankind, and we'll talk about his sixth trip and causes of war and so on. It's a fascinating tale. It's awkward to talk about Beelzebub's tales, eh, Jim? It's so peculiar in ways, and the language
is hard to
convey the impact of the book and the subtlety of it all.
It's so distinct and unique that it's hard to convey a sense of it, but you have to understand it too, which is, it's hard to understand a lot of, there's a lot of things in there. I have no idea what he's saying, and none, zero. So,
But
anyway, that's part of the intrigue of it too, is that, you try to keep working to try to figure out what's going on here.
Yeah, I think it'll be easier next week. Actually, we'll focus on what Gurdjieff says about the psychopathology of humankind.
Yeah,
and that is easier to understand really than his stories, which are very peculiar in his language, because he's got a very concise explanation of the psychology of human beings. About the formation of a false consciousness system and how the sacred being impulse is passed into the unconscious and so on. So we'll pick up on that, and I do think it's worth our trying to explain some of this really very remarkable book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. Okay, so go ahead, Jim.
No, good.
Great. Okay, so we'll be back in 2 weeks. Keep up your readings.
Yeah.
And I'm doing a new edit of this book. I've added a significant amount of material, actually, depicting his different visits and some of the history. I've added 20, 30 pages to what will be the next edition of The Slugs.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
And if you can send me piece that you're preparing for the Esoteric Quarterly, I'd really like to look at it, actually. Yeah.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay.
Yeah, because I have just...
Thanks.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Thank you, BBS Radio, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. All you strange three-centered beings out there. Okay, take care. Thank you all. Goodbye.
Yeah.